Nancy Barnes is a sociology professor at Drake University who studies grief and justice. As I read an article that she wrote recently about the importance of Holocaust Remembrance Day, it struck me that her framework had a lot in common, a lot of intersections with the disciples' experiences of the resurrection. Burns's article, Why Remembering Matters for Healing, names four reasons for memorializing and ritualizing, four reasons to celebrate things like Holocaust Remembrance Day. But I think that with her structure, this can be even bigger than just Memorial Day. As her title, Why Remembering Matters for Healing, suggests, telling our stories of our past, especially our traumas, how we live, impacts how we live the rest of our lives. First, telling our stories can help us to grieve by providing an outlet for emotion, a way to process a loss, a way to explore and express how a loss has impacted our lives. Memorials and rituals also help us to develop bonds, both bonds with the deceased, bonds that now have to be communicated and experienced in a different way than they had been before, and bonds with one another. Telling someone's story helps us to stay connected to them. It helps us to keep their memory alive in our hearts, and it helps to bring them alive to others. Burns' third reason for recommending memorials and rituals in the grieving process is that we document history through them, through the stories that we share. We help new people, in fact, often even new generations, to hear the stories, to be impacted by them, to be moved by them, and hopefully to learn from them. And lastly, by memorializing and witnessing to our grief, particularly when a death has been unjust, we inspire other movements. Burns was writing to encourage people to keep celebrating Holocaust Remembrance Day, but I couldn't help but see how her four points also connected to the disciples' experience of Jesus after the resurrection, which was our gospel passage today. Now, because I'm conscious that Easter was 3 weeks ago, I'm also conscious that many of you may not realize that the gospel passage that I read today actually takes place on Easter night, literally 12 to 13 hours after the women found the tomb empty. In order to understand this passage, we need to put our heads back into that Easter time frame, into that Easter headspace. Think about it. Sure, there was the wonder and awe of the empty tomb, but that had not quite yet crystallized into people's minds and hearts. The disciples didn't quite understand Easter and the resurrection and the empty tomb yet. What they did understand was Good Friday, the violence of the world, the finality of death. They did understand that their very lives were in danger. In order for us, therefore, to understand this passage, we have to grasp that this story is about how the early church dealt with the trauma and grief of the crucifixion and resurrection. First, in the text, we hear Jesus saying, "Peace be with you. Peace be with you." Over and over and over again in the post-resurrection passages, this is Jesus' refrain. Peace be with you. My peace I give to you. This is the very most common thing that Jesus says after the resurrection. Think about it. After he has come back from the dead, something that no one has ever done before or since, the centerpiece of what he says to people is, "Peace be with you." What this tells us is that this is absolutely central, absolutely core to what Jesus was about. Both personal, internal peace, and communal, relational, societal peace. Jesus continually knocks his disciples over the head with peace, peace, and more peace. When people are troubled, when hurt and pain and struggle and maybe even trauma are right in front of us, Christ's refrain is, "Peace I leave with you. Peace I give to you." The scriptures tell us that it is the peace that surpasses all understanding. It's not a peace that we can make sense of. It's God's peace. A peace in our hearts and our minds and our world. The next important message of this passage that we hear in several ways, that Jesus communicates to his disciples that he is real, that it's really him, like John was saying in the children's message. First, he shows the disciples his hands and feet. There was a tradition in first century Palestine that you're being able to touch someone's extremities and feel that there were bones in them was a way to be able to tell that they weren't a ghost. So the fact that Jesus showed them his hands and his feet helped to communicate to his early listeners that he wasn't a ghost. Then he says, "I am." When's the last time we heard that, or better yet, when's the first time that we heard that in the scriptures? He tells us that "I am he." Ego and me. We heard it a long time ago in the scriptures. Way back at the burning bush, right? That's what God says when Moses asks, "What shall I tell them your name is? Who is it that I shall tell you, tell my, your people sent me?" Ego and me. I am. So Jesus is here again saying, "It is me." And then he asks for something to eat. And as John said in the children's sermon, eating demonstrates physicality. If a ghost were to eat one of the organic fruit snacks that John gave out, they would put it into their mouth, and the idea was that it would drop right to the floor. But because Jesus was able to put the fish in his mouth and it didn't drop right to the floor, that was another sign to first century Palestinians that this was a real manifestation of Jesus, not a ghost. All of these are important because they are how first century Christian community expressed through their memorializing and their retelling of the Jesus story that he wasn't just a ghost, that this was different from any other spiritual or supernatural experience people had ever had. Then we hear that Jesus tells the ancient stories again, reinterprets the scriptures in light of these new developments. Have you ever had to go back and read a book over once you got to the end to try to figure out all of the pieces that you had missed, all of the connections that you hadn't realized were going to coalesce into something? Or maybe if it wasn't a book, maybe it was a movie. Watching it a second time, you suddenly realize all of the things that you had missed the first time. That's always how I imagine it working with Jesus, when Jesus interprets the scriptures for the disciples after the resurrection. He goes all the way back to the beginning of the scriptures and helps them to connect the dots that they hadn't been able to connect before. It's the post-game analysis, the processing of a movie with a friend, a book group discussion where you help to connect the dots and realize the things that you might have missed on your own. And then lastly, Jesus gives us a commission. He tells us that we are to share the good news of repentance and forgiveness, not just with the people in our tribe, but with everyone. How is this like Holocaust remembrance? Did you hear the connections between the power of Holocaust remembrance and our gospel? People tell the story as an outlet of grief and to help process their loss. Telling the story helps them to maintain bonds with the deceased and with one another. Sharing these stories is how we make them come alive for new people and new generations. And all of this culminates in an inspiring spiritual movement and action. Most of you know that my favorite question to ask toward the end of a sermon is, so what? What does this matter? How is this going to impact my life? How can I apply this at my office or amidst my relationships? It reminds me today of an experience that I had just this last Easter weekend. A friend had called and wanted some pastoral advice. It seems that she and her husband had a neighbor who was recently widowed. They had brought him a meal shortly after his wife's death, and now my friend said that he was hinting that he didn't have anywhere to go for Easter dinner. Her question of me was, what is the Christian thing to do? What do you think? What is the Christian thing to do? From your giggles, my guess is that most of you are thinking, well, it's probably to invite the fellow for Easter dinner. Using this passage, the Christian thing to do is to encourage peace in someone else's soul, to recognize that Jesus often comes amongst us in the guise of a stranger, to live the scriptures in the light of his message of love and inclusion, and to share the good news beyond our four walls. Your instinct to invite this fellow for dinner is borne up in our passage here. My friend had called asking what the Christian thing to do was. You all answered quickly and confidently. She didn't need a pastor's opinion. She also actually didn't want one. She spent most of our conversation trying to get me to help her to justify not inviting the newly widowed neighbor to Easter dinner. In the end, my friend's Easter table did not include one more place setting for the stranger. And I'm afraid that Easter dinner was a little less Christ-like in turn. Friends, my prayer on this fourth Sunday after Easter is that we will internalize these stories of Jesus, that we will more memorialize him and ritualize his message so profoundly that his message and his ways will determine who we invite to dinner. May it be so.